From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, why the project to stop an invasive fish from reaching Lake Michigan has ground to a halt.
And if we allowed carp to find their way into the Great Lakes, we believe it would have a devastating impact and a potential full collapse of what is a nearly $20 billion industry.
Also, a West Michigan community reckons with the toll of domestic violence.
When something so tragic and something of that nature unfortunately reminds people that violence does happen next door. Violence does happen. It doesn't discriminate against the community. It doesn't discriminate against your neighborhood.
And the mystery behind a false plagiarism claim. Somebody didn't want stories about a UP data mine to come up in your searches.
What's fascinating is just the lengths that these companies, these unknown entities, went to pull the stories down.
Those stories coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we have a truly wild story for you about a small-scale data farm in the eastern UP and the apparent conspiracy to keep it off the web.
What's fascinating is just the lengths that these companies, these unknown entities, went to pull the stories down.
We're going to tell you about that in just a bit, but first, work has come to a halt on a project that many observers believe is our last chance at preventing invasive carp from visiting Lake Michigan. There's a species of carp that's been tracked to a pool on the Illinois River, some 80 miles away from Lake Michigan. State wildlife regulators and multiple environmental groups have been monitoring the spread of these fish. They pose significant threats to native species like whitefish, which, as you may remember, are already experiencing a population collapse in Lake Michigan. An innovative construction project planned with bipartisan support from Michigan and other states, plus the federal government, might be able to stop these carp from reaching the lake, but a federal administrative review has now brought the work to a halt. Andrea Densham is Director of Regional Government Affairs at the Alliance for the Great Lakes. Andrea, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about why invasive carp pose such a threat to species that are native to Michigan and Illinois?
They're really good at two things, eating and reproducing. And they eat the exact same food source that our native fish eat, and that way putting a real pressure on our native fish and the competition that happens in the lakes. And as you noted, we already are having some challenges in our Great Lakes. The invasive mussels that have found their way into our lakes have had a really devastating impact on the ecology, made it very challenging for native fish, including our treasured whitefish. And if we allowed carp to find their way into the Great Lakes, we believe it would have a devastating impact and a potential full collapse of what is a nearly $20 billion industry.
Yeah. Are there other waterways that we can talk about that invasive carp have entered in North America? Is there anything you can tell us about other places that they've entered the ecosystem?
They found their way up the Mississippi River, and the reason why they're as close as they are to Lake Michigan is they've moved from southern parts of the United States, from tributaries into the Mississippi River and on their way up. And as they've done that, they've outcompeted the native fish in those regions. So we're seeing a decrease in the diversity of native fish in that area, something that has been a deep concern for many of us for many years. They truly are outcompeting the native fish. They are also eating up all of the plankton there and making it really challenging for us to be able to help reset those native fish back in those places. The last thing we want is for them to come into Lake Michigan and the other Great Lakes. And we're deeply concerned that what has happened in the Mississippi River can happen here in the Great Lakes.
So the project that I mentioned a little bit earlier, let's talk about what the plan has been to try to stop the spread. This project is called the Brandon Road Interbasin Project. Can you give us a little background on where it's located and what it took to set it into motion?
Absolutely. It started in motion after the 2009, 2010, really deep fear when there were some adult carp finding their way nearly into Lake Michigan. The result of that, unfortunately, was the use of fishicide, which killed thousands of fish, including native fish. So everyone worked together really, really hard to create the Brandon Road Lock and Dam barrier project, which includes multiple different barriers. It's an engineered channel for, so, our shipping channel from Lake Michigan to Mississippi River, where we move shipping back and forth, and we needed to find a place where we could stop it from finding its way into Lake Michigan. That's a choke point right there at Brandon Lock and Dam. So we now have multiple different layers of deterrence, from acoustic to electric, to some bubble barriers, and all of those were intended to keep the fish from making their way into Lake Michigan.
I was reading up on how this process works, and honestly, I've never seen anything like it. You gave us a little taste, but can you explain the different kinds of mechanisms in this channel that are designed to deter the carp?
Absolutely. So this is an engineered channel. It's used by shipping to move from the Great Lakes into the Mississippi River Basin. And the engineered channel that we're in the midst of build they're in the midst of building right now has a flushing lock, has bubble curtains, a deterrent, has acoustic deterrents, has electric deterrents, and even has a thing called an ABC deterrent, which keeps things off of the ships as they move through. All of these are layered on top of each other so that if one fails, the other catches. And it's really intentionally designed to be the last preventative efforts to keep the fish out of the lakes.
Stage after stage of fish hazing. I didn't even realize there were noises you could make that would keep fish from trying to enter an area.
So silverhead, which are actually the ones that they recently found, IDNR and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services found hundreds of these between 4 to 6 inch fish just in the last couple weeks. Those fish are very, very sensitive to sound. In fact, jump out of the lakes or rivers that they're in. You folks may have seen videos of really large fish jumping out of rivers and into boats or hitting people. And it's because they're super sensitive to the sound of motors or other sounds. And so the acoustic barriers really work efficiently to keep them out.
That's wild.
Yeah.
When did you become aware that construction on the Brandon Road Interbasin project had stopped?
We had learned in late July that on a Friday that the workers were told that there was a stop work order. And since then, governors of Michigan and Illinois, our Great Lakes Task Force, which is bipartisan task force in support of the Great Lakes in Congress, has been contacting the U.S. Army Corps, trying to find out why there has been a stop work order. And there has been no explanation to date. Our hope is for workers to get back to work. These are really specialized workers, and there's really specialized equipment that's needed. So when they're not there, there's a delay. There's going to be a delay even when we get a green light today, because they're going to need to get those workers back there and to get those specialized equipment back on site. Every day we're wasting taxpayer dollars, and we'd like to get workers back to work to protect our Great Lakes.
You mentioned the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. My understanding is that they're coordinating this project. Have you been able to get any information about who called the stoppage?
So our understanding that the U.S. Army Corps headquarters requested the stoppage and instructed the workers and the company. It's a Wisconsin-based company that's been doing great work on the site, and they were asked to stop, told to stop, and they haven't been working since.
Andrea, have you been able to get any detail on what kind of administrative review is happening? Like, whose decision is this going to be? Do we even know yet?
Yeah, the U.S. Army Corps could begin this now, but the White House also could provide instructions to start this again. In May of this year, the White House made a statement saying that this project should move at maximum speed and efficiency. And having a work stoppage like this in the middle of the summer, while it's the peak time to do this work, we're in a very seasonal place. We know what winters can be like around here. That is not maximum speed and efficiency. So we're hoping that the White House can instruct the U.S. Army Corps to begin work immediately.
Folks may recall this was an issue that our state's Governor Gretchen Whitmer took up with President Trump directly in a White House meeting that was, it really got a lot of attention at the time. Have you seen any obvious pressure points where elected officials in Michigan and Illinois can turn to try to get action on this?
Well, we're hoping everyone in the Great Lakes Basin, whether it's Michigan, Illinois, Wisconsin, Ohio, Minnesota, we hope that our entire delegation in Congress, which it has jointly has said together, including Republican leads in Michigan, that we want this to begin again. You know, as I said, this is a universally supported project, and everyone has worked hand in glove to move it forward. From what I've seen and from what the Alliance has seen, we're seeing everyone speaking in one voice, whether it's governors and leaders in Congress, all asking for an explanation and for work to begin again. I think it's really challenging when we don't have a good explanation and we have workers ready to go, very specialized workers, and they're just being asked to stand on the sidelines and not being able to do their quality work on the lock and dam.
Folks who have been close observers of the administration in matters like trade with Canada have observed that leverage seems to go a long way. Is there any kind of leverage that the states can put on the federal government to try to get a timely solution to this delay?
Well, we're really hoping that the White House can appreciate that the workers that are trying to do their work and the company that is specialized from Wisconsin that was contracted to do this work, are exactly the kind of economic drivers that we want to be supporting, right? We want to be working and supporting those folks doing using specialized materials, using specialized skilled construction workers to do this kind of work. And we'd hope that in a moment where our economy's tight, that you'd want to be able to support states like Michigan, states like Wisconsin, who are having tough economic times, and get those workers back on the lock and dam.
Andrea, how long do you think the states reasonably have to do something about this? As I mentioned, we're talking a distance of, about 80 miles for, for one of these invasive species. What does the clock look like from where you sit?
The clock is really concerning right now. I mean, we were concerned when we found out in the end of July that the work stoppage had happened, but then finding hundreds of growing silver carp and them moving closer and closer means that we could be at that place where we were back in 2009. And that's the last thing we need, is to have to think about some of the more severe kind of fishicides or other interventions. We built the support for this lock and dam in order for us to have this solution work, and we need to save the $20 billion industries, and we should do that today.
Andrea Densham has been my guest, Director of Regional and Government Affairs at the Alliance for the Great Lakes. Andrea, great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
When we come back, a conversation about emergency and support services for people experiencing domestic violence.
It can be really confusing that someone that, should be treating you with respect and love and care is hurting you.
You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Grand Haven Township and much of West Michigan is, in a sense, still recovering from a truly horrible thing that happened this summer, a murder-suicide involving a mother and her six children at the hands of those children's father. This tragedy opened up a larger discussion about how abuse can turn deadly and the path to preventing intimate partner violence. India Ambrose is my guest today. She works at Resilience in Holland. That's a shelter that does emergency services and also provides some longer-term support for surviving families. India Ambrose, welcome to Stateside. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And Katie Edsbords is here as well. She's the Director of Research into Interpersonal Violence at the University of Michigan. Katie, welcome. It's good to have you.
Thank you. Happy to be here, April.
Katie, research shows us that something in the neighborhood of 60 to 64% of murder-suicide incidents involve current or former intimate partners. Is there any way to know when situations are likely to escalate?
Sure. So when we think of intimate partner violence or domestic violence, we know that it happens on a continuum, right? And so things that may not be seen as, even violence for a lot of people. I think there can be normalization, but even things like, a partner saying something to put another partner down, or controlling behaviors, things like not allowing a partner to hang out with friends, or jealousy. Those can be certainly warning signs, or even seeing, an individual who's, talking about their partner. Maybe they're not quite recognizing, that the partner saying, "I don't want you to go hang out with your friends," is necessarily a problem. And so I think that research shows that there are often earlier warning signs before violence can escalate. Absolutely intimate partner violence can happen behind closed doors, but there's often signs that neighbors, community members, coworkers may notice. And so the approach that we are really studying in our lab is, how do we engage community members in recognizing that violence is unacceptable in our community, all forms of violence, including intimate partner violence, and what can we do to best support survivors? And also really thinking about that we all have a role to play, both in preventing violence and supporting survivors. So really the importance of what we can do in recognizing often those, what we would consider maybe more lower threshold behaviors, lower severity behaviors, before they escalate into something much more severe, including intimate partner homicide.
Andy, I want to ask a little bit more about your work. What are some of the core needs that survivors may have? Obviously, some people may not recognize or may not acknowledge right away that they're in this kind of situation. What informs the kinds of things that resilience tries to do for folks?
When you're, as Katie just kind of talked about with intimate partner violence and the violence that we deal with, which is we work with domestic violence, sexual violence, stalking survivors. And when we talk about that, a little into also what Katie touched on with like the power and control dynamic that's happening behind closed doors, but also there's a touch of, okay, well, community members, how do we engage them to understand what's happening right next door, what's happening in your family? And one of the things that's a really big barrier for survivors are when people say, like, why didn't you just leave? Why didn't you just go? One of the biggest things of that is the most deadliest time for a survivor is when they're leaving. That there's a loss of power and there's a loss of control on the abuser's end. So we're here to meet survivors where they are. That could be a survivor looking to leave by tomorrow. That could be a survivor looking to leave and safety plan over a few months. That can look like a survivor looking for just some advice about dealing with the situation as they realize that maybe I am in an abusive situation. We meet survivors where they are if they know that they're in a situation or they don't. And we meet them with comprehensive, free, and confidential care so that they're not considering cost when it comes to, for example, we have trauma-informed therapy for survivors and their children. We're not contacting your insurance for the abuser to know what's going on. Like, there's so many steps that we can take to ensure that sometimes it's just getting you in the door. We take walk-ins, so sometimes it's just someone walking in saying like, "Ah, something's going on. I don't know what's happening," and we'll have trained advocates who can sit with you in that. It can look like someone being assaulted sexually, and they're not really quite sure what they want to do next. But when you come here, you don't have to report to the police. When you come here, we have in-house exams, and you can come in and say, "I need an exam today," sit on that table and decide you don't want to. So that's kind of overarching what we do is we meet survivors where they are. We don't place blame. We always lead with, "We believe you, and here's how we can help."
Katie, would you say that the interventions that may not involve law enforcement or may not involve, public services or like the county getting involved with children, does that make any difference in how survivors respond and make their own decisions?
Yeah, so we actually know from research that the majority of survivors do tell someone that they have been or are being abused. They may not use those exact words, of course, right? Because we know a lot of survivors may not necessarily recognize it as abuse, or they may call it something different. But we do know that the majority, it depends, you see estimates ranging for different reasons, but the majority do tell someone that they are being abused. And so we know that that is such a critical opportunity for community members, friends, and family to play a role in helping them to access services and reiterating, you know, this isn't your fault. I'm here to support you. We're going to get the help you need. And the interesting thing is that when individuals disclose, the most common person they're disclosing to is friends and family. We know that actually the majority of survivors don't actually go to the police. They don't actually tell, you know, a doctor or a counselor, that the majority are telling informal supports. And so friends and family. And so that's why it's so, so important for us as community members, us as neighbors. You know, we may be working with someone, at church with someone, they may be someone we stand at the bus stop with when we're putting our kids on the bus. And those really, really small moments sometimes can make the difference in saving someone's life.
What happened last month with the Karolkowitz family just shattered people. It was very horrific and very shocking. India, do you find that when something very public like that takes place and people are seeing it in the news, is it ever the case that resilience experiences an uptick of people reaching out because of their own situations? Is the public awareness makes a difference?
Yes, I think when something so tragic and something of that nature unfortunately reminds people that violence does happen next door. Violence does happen. It doesn't discriminate against the community. It doesn't discriminate against your neighborhood. Violence is happening. And I think when something that horrific happens right next door to with people that you know, you love, classmates, friends, coworkers, when something of that nature happens in your community, you know, we're seeing the uptick of people saying, hey, I'm noticing some patterns. Hey, I noticed something happening in my life. Or, hey, I'm concerned about my sister. I'm concerned about my parent. It raises concerns in the community to the point where more community members are reaching out, like, what do I do? How can I help? How can something like this happen right next door? What can we do? So it raises questions in the community as to, like, what do we do about something like this? And then it increases survivors coming in the door, realizing that they're in a situation that could become deadly, or they're in a situation that is just point blank period abuse. So there's definitely an uptick of calls. We have a helpline that's 24/7. It's going to be ringing off the hook because more and more people are identifying that in their own lives, in their own community, with their friends. So we definitely are seeing an uptick in people reaching out to us.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are India Ambrose from Resilience, a shelter in West Michigan, and Katie Edwards, who directs research into interpersonal violence at the University of Michigan within the School of Social Work. Katie, why would you say, what are the reasons why it sometimes just takes time and why people are reluctant to ask for help? I mean, you mentioned the fact that when you're leaving, that's when it can be the most dangerous. But what are reasons why people might not even self-identify that this is something that's happening to them?
Sure. So a lot of the work that we do in the lab, we look at the process of disclosure, and we know that there's a number of barriers that people experience to disclosing. One is certainly fear, being fearful of what could happen to you, your children, you know, retaliation. These are often people that you love, that you have children with, and it can be really confusing that someone that, you know, should be treating you with respect and love and care is hurting you. And so that process of actually labeling this as, this isn't okay, and like, I need to do something about that, can take some time. And so we definitely know that there can be that process of recognizing it. Also hoping the person's going to change, thinking, okay, this is isolated, it's not going to happen again. When in reality, we know that these things do often escalate. Fear of embarrassment, being concerned that, like, I'm going to be judged if I go and seek help, or, you know, what if they don't understand my situation? And I think a lot of times, you know, that there's amazing services that India is sharing today where these services exist, and it's helping survivors to know that they can access them. So we do know that there are a number of barriers, and sometimes, you know, in the research we've done, sometimes they can be kind of like these final straws or breaking points. And, you know, oftentimes you see that, if, you know, especially if there's kids, right, and involved, or somebody comes and says something to you. Hey, I've noticed that you seem really down. What's going on? Or hey, I saw last weekend when he was talking to you this way, and that's really, I'm really worried about that because you deserve to be talked to with respect. And so I really feel like there are a number of barriers when it comes to disclosing. It's often a process. And again, there are often, I think, these moments where we as community members, friends, and family may notice some of these things and can, I think even as friends and family, can meet survivors where they're at. And our job isn't to say, get out of this relationship. It's to say, I'm concerned about you. I care about you. I want to help you. Can we figure this out together?
Yeah, it's just a lot. India, you told us about the initial response after, something very public happens. Are there ways that an incident of a very public incident of abuse like that, are there ways that that shapes the community that you serve?
That's a really good question. I think like I was saying before, when it happens in your community or happens to someone that it shakes you. It shakes you up. It you ask a lot of questions about the what ifs. That when everyone is kind of in also a state of also not truly fully understanding, even someone as close as a family member, not truly understanding what's going on, maybe not seeing the abuse behind closed doors, so that this particular incident seems so sudden to the community, right? And that's what happens when we feel as if violence isn't happening and we're not able to identify that. Then when something, becomes a tragedy, I think that changes everyone's mind in the community about what's really happening. And also, I think that also, like, for example, resilience has been here. We've been here since 1977. So next year's our 50-year anniversary. So we've been doing this since the 70s. We've been addressing violence since the 70s. And over that time, there's going to be different incidents that affect your community. I think that we've been responding to all types of violence for so long. And I think that even then, until something of this stature happens, I don't know if the community is identifying everything that comes before that, if that makes sense. So I think it definitely does shape the community that you're in when you start to realize, oh, like this is happening often, even if it's not ending in tragedy.
India, folks who are listening right now, some may be in the Holland area, but we have a lot of listeners in a lot of different communities too. Is there anything that survivors can do if they want to receive help, but they just feel kind of paralyzed, like they don't know how? They don't know what they're letting themselves in for if they contact a shelter?
Yeah. One thing I would say that I want, survivors to know, anyone listening, community members, is just that, like I mentioned before, resilience, specifically speaking of us, is like, we're here. And when I also mentioned earlier about all the staff that care, that was also a piece I wanted to hit home when it comes to coming and anywhere, wherever is in your service area. But speaking for resilience, I can say there are people here that care. You're going to always be met with belief. You're going to always be met with respect. You're going to always be met with a menu of options, and you decide. Your power and your control are, you're giving that back to yourself. Also something we never want to take credit for the work that a survivor does. So it's all about when you're ready, we're here, we're meeting you where you are. And I think that's really important. It's hard when you don't know what you're going through. That's why I've been taking steps to make sure, for example, our social media might have just some facts about consent or some facts about just different education pieces to where you might see it and scroll and save it. And over time, start to realize, oh, these things are speaking to me. Even like I mentioned before, you can call our 24/7 helpline and just say, I think something's going on. I don't know. That's why we call it a helpline, not a crisis line, because you may not know you're in a crisis. You might just want to say, hey, like, this was weird. What do you think? Our advocates are so trained to respond. And also something I want to reiterate, too, is like, I would consider us a comprehensive a comprehensive organization that provides. We do have emergency shelter. We do have the helpline. We have trauma-informed therapy. You can come here and get an exam done if you have been in an assault. And there are no points of judgment. And everyone welcomes you with open arms. Everyone welcomes you with empathy. Everything we do is trauma-informed first, survivor first. We never speak as if we're saviors because you're doing the work. And as Katie also mentioned, with some of the prevention efforts, we are also striving to do that as well, where when you said the word champions, we actually have a Champions of Healthy Manhood program. And just the leadership of that is amazing, where, we're going into these classrooms and speaking to the young men on the rugby team, on the football team, and talking about consent and protecting the women around you, and starting young, as you mentioned. Like, all of that is showing that the community here is. We're not ignoring the problem, and we're not saying that prevention isn't important. We're not just responding to crisis. We are meeting you where you are at every step. You can say no to everything and come back next year and say, I'm ready. So I want to hit that home, is that you can make the choice even if you don't know and can't identify that what's happening to you is abuse.
My guests today have been India Ambrose of Resilience in Holland and Katie Edwards of the University of Michigan School of Social Work. She directs research into interpersonal violence. Katie, good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And India, thank you so much for everything you're doing, too. And we appreciate your time talking today.
Thank you. It's been great talking with you guys.
It's time for a break now. When we come back, a mysterious copyright claim on stories about a Florida congressional candidate's Michigan Bitcoin business.
This is a data center in Dafter Township in the eastern Upper Peninsula. Specifically, it is a Bitcoin mine. So it is this collection of supercomputers that are doing very complicated equations in order to earn Bitcoin.
AJ Jones from WCMU is going to fill us in just a minute. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A Michigan reporter we know recently had to defend his work regarding a data center in the eastern Upper Peninsula to Google to avoid being censored on search engine results. This story focuses on a man named Michael Carbonara, a Republican candidate who ran for Congress in Florida, and his ties to a controversial data center. But after receiving multiple bogus claims, claiming that the story was plagiarizing other news outlets, Google made the decision to pull it as Florida's early voting got underway. AJ Jones at WCMU is the reporter who has been covering this story, and we invited us to tell us about this pretty way out situation. AJ, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I guess we should start with the first way that you interacted with the story, the data center. Can you tell us about where it's located and what you first learned of it when you started asking around?
Sure. So this is a data center in Dafter Township in the eastern Upper Peninsula. Specifically, it is a Bitcoin mine. So it is this collection of supercomputers that are doing very complicated equations in order to earn Bitcoin. The thing about it is they run quite hot and they need fans in order to cool them down to stop them from overheating. And these fans can run quite loud. The kicker about this particular Bitcoin mine is that it is located across the street from a K-12 school, Lake Superior Academy, which is a school that puts a lot of emphasis on outdoor learning. The school has been in a consistent back and forth with the people running this Bitcoin mine. At issue is the noise. The school says that the noise is too loud and it's stopping the kids from learning, and they say that it eventually forced them to stop on a planned expansion, the school that is. And what's happening now is there is a lawsuit. The school is suing the organization that owns the mine and owns the mine itself. They're currently tied up in a court, I believe a state court. The next hearing happens to be sometime next month, in the middle of next month. And this has been a long-going sort of story that we've been following from the beginning.
AJ, I don't want to get us too far afield, but I believe you visited the place where the school and the data center are, right?
I didn't. My colleague Teresa Holmesy did. This was sometime last year. And the noise, we put out a video on our socials. The noise is, it is very noticeable, and it definitely went viral. Now, for what it's worth, there's two companies involved here. Odessa, who own the land and who I'll talk about a little bit in a second, and another company called AlphaWatt, who own the actual mine on it. They have tried some mitigation efforts. They put hay bales in front of the data centers, in front of the Bitcoin mines at some point. And they are also in this court battle. At some point, they also claim that because they were hit with a temporary restraining order, they had to stop operation on the mine, and that cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars. So this is becoming a pretty protracted legal fight between the two sides here.
Huh. When you think about the sound that was captured on Teresa's recordings, would you say it's comparable to like cars going by or closer to the sound of a train? Or are you able, do you have a sense? Yeah.
Yeah, off the top of my head, I believe it was around 70 decibels. So this is comparable to like a blender, for example.
Thanks for that. Okay, so how did you first learn the name of Michael Carbonara?
So the people who operate this, who are behind this mine, they've been pretty esoteric, and people in the Dafter community have not had really any contact with the ultimate, I guess, owner of this mine, so to speak. But Carbonara comes into the story because his name is on the permit that was submitted and approved by Dafter Township, and he is in the legal filings. His name shows up in the legal filings for the company Odessa, I mentioned. Odessa is the company that owns the land that the mine is located on. And to find Carbonara's name, we had to go through a slew of different active and inactive companies in Florida's business listings. Carbonara is a businessman who was running for Congress in the state of Florida. He was one of the many candidates running in the primaries back on the 18th, and he has not really said much about the mine that we could find, but, and this is sort of getting into my story I wrote about him, on the campaign trail, he was running in the U.S. House for a seat in the Palm Beach area. I believe that's Florida's 22nd district. And he essentially made oblique references to having built a data center, a Bitcoin mine. Now, he didn't mention the Dafter mine by name, but he did mention that he has built a Bitcoin mine. And he did mention that it was running with power that was generated by a electric co-op. And the Dafter mine happens to get power, rather, from Cloverland Electric. So there's details in what Carbonara said that line up with the Dafter mine. So while we can't definitively say that Carbonara mentioned this mine specifically, we felt it was worth mentioning because it's the most noteworthy reference he's made to Bitcoin mines at all. And we wrote a story about his comments on the trail.
So you said that Michael Carbonara was running for Congress. How did his campaign end up turning out?
He lost the primary election by a little over 20 points. He was running against Casey Askar, who is a much more established politician. Carbonara was one of the many politicians who had their races upended when Florida redrew its districts earlier this year to be more favorable to the GOP. He was moved into this district, seat 22 in the Palm Beach area, and his connection to the Bitcoin mine became this big campaign issue because in Palm Beach, there was this proposed data center, unrelated, called Project Tango. And this was a real source of local controversy. People came out and opposed it, concerns about the environmental impact and noise, and eventually local politicians blocked that particular data center. And Carbonara was one of the voices who came out in opposition to Project Tango, and he said he wanted more local control of data centers. But his own connections to this Bitcoin mine became sort of a source of scrutiny during his campaign, and eventually someone, we don't know who, started filing DMCA copyright complaints against stories that connected him to this Bitcoin mine.
Okay, so far so good. How was it that you found out that stories you had written that mentioned Carbonara had been pulled, and that if people wanted to Google information about them, either because they lived in Michigan and they wanted to know, or because they lived in Florida and were researching Carbonara, that they wouldn't have access to that work?
Yeah, so there was one specific story at issue, and that was me writing about his comments about having built a Bitcoin mine at a sort of campaign forum. in Florida. So I found out the day after we wrote that story on July 31st, I was actually off work that day. I got a text from my editor saying, oh, hey, our story, someone filed a false copyright claim against our story. And this was something that we were essentially accused by some organization, Davenport Industries, of having wholesale copied the article. I was accused of basically lifting the article from a different website. They said that we stole the website from the Tallahassee Democrat, which is a USA Today website. Now, Davenport Industries, it's not really clear who these people are, and they obviously have no connection with USA Today, but they filed a complaint with Google saying that we had wholesale copied the article from the Tallahassee Democrat, and that they had reached out to WCMU's leadership in an attempt to remedy the issue. And according to WCMU's leadership, there was no such contact. They never reached out to us. No one ever reached out to us about our story having been stolen.
AJ, I hate to interrupt, but I just have to say, this is a conversation that no reporter wants to ever have to have with their editor. Did you have to go through the process of trying to explain to your editor and other managers that this was a false claim?
So it was, I'll be blunt, this was very obviously a false claim from the start. For the reasons I kind of mentioned, no one ever reached out to us about this, and no company named Davenport Industries is connected to the Tallahassee Democrat at all. Some random third party filed a claim with Google accusing us of having stolen the work. And so I was not involved in the counterclaim process, but what ended up happening is WCMU's lawyer, Karen Post, reached out to Google and filed what you can do is when you get hit with one of these claims, and we can talk more about the process in a bit, but when you get hit with these claims, you can file a counterclaim, essentially saying that there was no content theft at all. And Google ended up, after that appeal, bringing the story back to its search engine results. That ended up being the process. And our lawyer looked out. I talked to Karen Post, and she said she found no info on these people. She didn't find anything about the entities. And it wasn't really clear as to what WCMU could have potentially stolen from these people. And quoting her directly, she told me, quote, the whole thing just seemed very suspicious.
I mean, I don't even know how you'd begin to figure out where these complaints were coming from. Did you get very far with that?
Well, actually, I don't think anyone has because, and this sort of gets into the next aspect of the story, this is a very widespread thing. It isn't just Davenport Industries. Several other outlets got hit with bogus claims by random unknown companies. I know of at least four other Florida-based outlets, the Sun Sentinel, the Floridian, website floridapolitics.com, and also WLRN, who are the NPR affiliate who represent South Florida. They were also hit with bogus copyright claims from completely unknown companies, and they also had their stories temporarily pulled down from Google. Now, like us, they often had to file counterclaims in order to get their work back, and Google brought the stories back. But someone, no one knows who, was pulling these stories down. And in particular, what's fascinating is just the lengths that these companies, these unknown entities, went to pull the stories down. One company, Pendrick Enterprises, so they filed a claim with Google, right? And they said that they were representing WLRN and that another website I mentioned, floridapolitics.com, had stolen an article from WLRN. So they're using one article about Carbonara in an attempt to take down another article about him. WLRN said they had nothing to do with that claim, right? So this is something that multiple outlets were experiencing. And I should be very clear, we reached out to the Carbonara campaign and they didn't respond to our request for comment. And there's no official link between us and these organizations. And I should say, in the days leading up to the actual race, Carbonara put out a statement about an unrelated story denying that his campaign had anything to do with these claims. So it's not really clear who was doing this, but they were going after a lot of outlets. I spoke to, for example, just before I get off of this, I spoke to Here and Now about this. They are NPR's afternoon show, WBUR, and some other random company filed a claim against WBUR's story. So it's pretty widespread. Someone somewhere was filing a lot of these copyright claims against a lot of organizations, and no one knows who did it.
AJ, this is wild. Did Google have any comment on the fact that they had sprung on the false claim and taken down the stories?
Yes, and I think it's worth mentioning how this process actually works. So I reached out to Google, and they told me, and I'm quoting a spokesperson here, the DMCA process is designed to efficiently assist rights holders while vigorously protecting free expression and combating fraudulent takedowns. And what they told me is that they have an automated and human review system, and that webmasters like us that are affected by mistaken removals can file a counter notice. They told me that they reviewed the request in question and took appropriate action. So the way copyright law works, federal law spelled out in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, online service providers like Google have to take down content that an IP holder claims violates IP law. So Google's hands are kind of tied by federal law. Now, the recourse is that the webmasters, so in this case us, can file a counterclaim, and Google has up to 2 weeks to put it back. This claim was obviously bogus, so our story was taken down on the 31st, and it came back up on the 3rd of August, the first Monday after the story was taken down. So it didn't take Google that long to figure out that this claim was bogus. So there's not much Google can do in these situations. Someone can, just kind of reach out to Google and take the stories down. And, as for why anyone would do this, I had a conversation with Lisa McGraw. She's a public policy manager at the Michigan Press Association. And she told me something that kind of stuck with me. If they're pulling your story down, they've accomplished something. So whoever was doing this might have been trying to maybe stifle the reach of these stories, because it doesn't take the story down from our website. It's still available to be found, but most people get their search engine results from Google. Most people use Google to browse the web. So if a story is pulled from Google's results, it makes it invisible to the majority of people that browse the internet. So maybe the point, whoever did this, was to maybe stifle our work and stifle the work of these other outlets, as opposed to successfully pulling it from the internet.
Man, I it's a whole new layer of vulnerability for work that gets published out there. AJ, for folks who are just listening who may have nothing to do with journalism and who are just trying to keep themselves informed, do you have any thoughts about safeguards, either on the industry side of things or just for people who are hearing this and trying to find out that when they're researching an issue that they're getting correct information and that they have access to the best possible reported information?
Yeah, and I don't have the best answer for what an industry-wide safeguard would be. Like I said, I know that organizations like Google have to abide by federal laws, but I think what ended up working the best in this case is that all the outlets I mentioned by name, at least the ones in Florida and us, all filed counterclaims and all got their stories back, and they all have written stories about having their work taken down. We did. WLRN has a very long-form article about their story being pulled because of a bogus copyright claim, as that was the case with all the other outlets. So I think the best safeguard is that when something like this does happen and people do abuse the DMCA system, is to use counterclaims and to sort of use your own outlet as a way to bring attention to this. This would have just been a standard story, standard spot that maybe we wouldn't have followed the day after, right? And ultimately, this is a story about an election happening in Florida. So this would have been something that would have just been another story, right? Obviously, one we're following closely, but it kind of took on a life of its own because someone tried to pull it down and we kept sort of following the thread. And we found that this was a pretty widespread thing. So I don't know if there is a neat safeguard that you can sort of place to make sure that people don't abuse the DMCA takedown system, but the best thing you can do is use your counterclaims and keep writing, I suppose.
AJ Jones reports at WCMU, based in Mount Pleasant. AJ, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you've ever been in the Upper Peninsula, I'm sure that you've seen signs for pasty shops along the road. Now, the pasty has deep cultural significance for generations of immigrants who came to the UP at the height of the copper mining boom, and for their descendants. What exactly does the pasty mean to you? We want to know if there's a family recipe that you grew up making, maybe something you still love to share. Maybe you successfully completed the Keweenaw Pasty Trail and lived to tell the story. Maybe you've gotten into an argument over what ingredients really belong in or on an authentic UP pasty. Whatever your connection to that flaky, savory goodness, we want to hear about it. You can reach us at this email address, onhand@michiganpublic.org. Or you can submit your story as a voice note on our submission form. Just head over to the On Hand page at michiganpublic.org. That's all for Stateside for today. Our show's producers are Ronia Kapansug, Michelle Jokishpolo, and April Van Buren. Our senior producer is Mercedes Mejia. And the executive producer of Stateside is Laura Weber Davis. Our show's interns are Isabella Jacob and Yeneva Sise. Stateside's a production of Michigan Public. Find out more at michiganpublic.org. We're a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.